This is Ken Howard, and I'm having a conversation, I guess you'd say bi-coastal, today with Harlan Coben, a marvelous author. We're both Amherst grads, both played basketball for the Lord Jeffs, and I'm thrilled to be able to talk with you, Harlan. And I just finished, actually, even though purportedly this interview was going to be about Hold Tight, and I would love to talk about a lot, I just finished Long Lost. It just came out to acclaim, which I thoroughly enjoyed, which was just great fun, back with Myron Bolitar. I thought one way to begin is I wish you could talk just a little bit about the very beginnings. I know the first thing, Deal Breaker, came right out and was nominated for an Edgar, and that's Myron Bolitar, right?
Yep.
I mean, at the beginning. And just those first steps of deciding not to go to the University of Chicago Law School, and obviously the right choice, and then start writing, if you didn't mind. Just kind of bring us back to that.
Yeah, I mean, at Amherst, I was a political science major, which, yeah, no offense to the other political science majors out there, but I always thought that was sort of a euphemism for I have no idea what I want to do with my life. I'm sure you probably had something similar, Ken, leaving wanting to act from Amherst, no?
I was an English major, and I always thought, you know, a lot of English majors went on to law school, even though they didn't want to be lawyers, they weren't going to pursue a PhD, and I was fortunate enough to get a fellowship to go to Yale Drama School, and I think at the time thought, well, this is an opportunity for a while, and we'll see what happens, and then once I got involved, never looked back, and I've always been thankful that I took the leap of faith. That's why I'm doubly curious about your choice to.
Well, that was sort of the same thing with me, where it was just sort of law school was that path of least resistance, the next step. My father and both of my brothers went to law school. My father was a lawyer. My brothers don't practice. So it was sort of that kind of next step. But at that, around my senior year at Amherst, I did start getting interested in wanting to write. And also, my grandfather and my mother ran a travel company that needed help. So I said, all right, I'll delay law school a year and then 2 years and go into the family business, as it were, and at the same time try to write. So that's kind of how it all started.
That's marvelous. And is it 95 that Deal Breaker came out?
Or 95, Deal Breaker came out. I had two, in my 20s, I had two other novels published to very small press. And actually, Deal Breaker, while it got a number of award nominations, it really did not explode out of the gate. I got very little money for it. It was just a paperback original. It was never in hardcover. In fact, that was true of the first four Myrons. It was a very slow and steady climb up the hill, but I started about as low as you could get. And it wasn't until Tell No One that I hit the New York Times bestseller list for the first time, which was nine books in. Or eighth book in, I guess.
Oh, and then, of course, the French film. And we talked about that the last time we were talking, of how that brings on a whole new audience, and not only France, but people who've now seen the film and are drawn and then go back and read some of your earlier work, I'm sure was reflected.
Yeah, it's always one of the great things about having a lot of books out there is, you know, when you're quote-unquote discovered by a new reader. And I always love that feeling, too, as a reader, when you find an author you haven't read before.
Yes.
You find somebody new and you go, wow, he's got 10 books back there I can go back and read. That's always a good feeling.
One of the through lines, too, I'm finding more and more that I love with the work that you do, even though you obviously have this rich fantasy land, life and can take us all over the place, but you really write so well about those things that you know, whether it's basketball or dealing with the family and children and the fears that we have or the things that we deal with as an audience. It's right there. It's in Long Lost, too. I mean, it's so current in terms of the things that cross our minds. I'm jumping around a bit, but the towards the end of Long Lost and this mad stem cell creation of the blonde, blue-eyed terrorist trained to do one thing, I think practically every reader that you have has thought how strange and how dangerous it is if terrorists aren't these bearded, you know, certain Sephardic-looking people that they're looking for in airports. What if they start having people that are the blonde, blue-eyed, you wouldn't look twice? I mean, it's occurred to me, and I'm sure to anyone else, that that's an issue that doesn't hasn't even been addressed, but it's just waiting there, and there it is in the book, in fiction, but also a concern, I mean, a consideration.
Yeah, I mean, I try always to stay in the modern world. I mean, I don't necessarily have cutting-edge technology. In fact, in both Hold Tight, which deals a lot with spyware and things like that in the computer, and Long Lost, which deals with some embryo research and things like that, none of the technology is that cutting edge or that difficult or that hard to find. None of it is also made up. All the stuff in both of those books can readily be done. It's just trying to figure out ways of tying that all together. And, you know, I want to work in the real world. I don't work with science fiction. I don't really, except with the exception of Long Lost, I really don't deal with huge subject matters. I deal more with personal tragedy, quiet tragedies, families, and those sort of emotions. And I hope even in a bigger book like Long Lost, it really is about the heart and soul. It's about Myron and Therese and their pursuit of what really happened to her daughter.
Yes, absolutely, and that goes through it. Also, I love Myron being your, well, we don't know each other that well, but this marvelous alter ego that has done all the things and says just the right remark, you know, the sort of, I wish I'd said that. And because it had been mentioned in an interview, your fondness for Raymond Chandler, and I must confess this weekend, because I had you on my mind and was reading some more of your work, I wound up, I decided to just tune in for a few minutes to watch The Maltese Falcon for another time. I hadn't seen it for a few years, but I've probably seen it 20 times, and wound up watching the whole thing. Sorry about it, a couple of hours long, and so I thought, there it was in terms of storytelling, and a lot of, I think, at the heart of what you do so well is, you know, page turning, oh, what's going to happen next, and it's hard to get ahead of. You know, it's enough twists and turns that it's very captivating.
Well, I try. I mean, my favorite quote on writing comes from Elmore Leonard, who says, I try to cut out all the parts you'd normally skip. Isn't that brilliant?
That's right.
I'm sure, actually, as an actor and in movies and plays, it's the same thing. You know, those moments you just want to get through. And when you feel those moments, you kind of have to say to yourself, well, how can I change this? How can I keep you absolutely riveted to the page and not want to go skipping ahead or put it down and watch a DVD or go on the computer? And I try to write with that kind of energy. I write about it, every page, every paragraph, every sentence, every word. I ask, is this compelling? Is this gripping? Is this moving the story forward? If it's not, I got to find a way around that.
Yeah, it really does have that, honestly.
Thanks.
It has that great energy. And I'm sure you noticed, probably knew anyway, with Tell No One, that it's interesting how in film, with one shot, or even sometimes for an actor with a nod, you can get a lot done. You know.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, one of the things that I loved about the way the French made Tell No One, and I'm not knocking Hollywood, but for example, there's a scene in Tell No One early on, this isn't giving it away, it's what the plot is about, where after his wife has been murdered, 8 years pass, and he sees her on a webcam.
Right.
And in Hollywood, you can just kind of imagine it would have had dramatic music, and he would have had this loud gasp, and it would have been all this sort of thing. And in this movie, Francois Clouzet, who plays the lead, barely reacts. You just see this flicker of shock in his eyes, very, very understated acting, which in a sense is more powerful than if they had done the histrionics that some directors might have gone for there.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there's much more, there's no music, there's almost nothing going on there. There's just one guitar playing through. And as a writer, too, you try to find those sort of moments where you can kind of underplay it, and that, you know, it's almost more real than the actual dramatics that you would sometimes find in film or in other books.
I've found, you know, sometimes it can just be bad directing or bad acting. Often, though, actually, I've found, at least in American film and certainly in television, it's a memo. It comes from a studio perspective or sort of a corporate perspective that assumes that the audience is really stupid. You know, believe me, they got it. You really, it's enough. You know, you don't have to. But there is a lot of that heavy-handedness, I think, really can come from that end, and I'm assuming that in the French film, just by definition, that voice isn't there pestering you.
Well, we had, I mean, the people that worked in this film had a lot, you know, we were pretty isolated, which was good.
Great.
The head producer was Luc Besson, who was a director in his own right, the talented guy.
Right.
So that I think there wasn't too many, quote-unquote, suits around to tell them what to do. But there's a lot of moments like that. I mean, there's also, I think, in the movie Tell No One, one of the great foot chase scenes I've ever seen in a movie.
Me too.
And when he runs, he's not knocking over the big fruit basket, you know what I mean? And people aren't shouting, hey, where are you going? You know, it's none of that. The people just sort of look at him like you would in real life. They go about their business. They notice he's running away from the police, but they don't want to necessarily get involved. And so it feels more real. And that's kind of also how I want to write. When I wrote that scene in this guy's head, because he's a nice pediatrician, he's like, oh my God, I'm running away from the police. You know, he's sort of in his own shock as he's trying to speed away with a real good reason, a chance to see his beloved wife who he thought was dead for 8 years, and he's just not going to prison before he has a chance. And that's the whole thing again. It's the heart, you know, in all the books, and in Long Lost, and in The Hold Tight, and in the case of Tell No One. It's really about the heart. If I could write a fast-paced plot. I can make your pulse sore. I can make your heart. I can make your pulse and brain sore. But the key is, if your heart doesn't soar, it's just not going to work. If you don't care about these people and what they're trying to do, it's just not going to work.
And your leading male characters, at least the ones I've read, are rather candid. I mean, in a male sort of way, about what they're feeling and how, and you know, the effect on their heart and their feeling, and with women and all. I mean, there is that. Among whether it's your, because you make him very human, Myron Bolitar, but I mean with the pediatrician, it always occurs to me too that your wife's a pediatrician, right?
So well, it's easy research.
You have a quick check, right?
My research literally was going, honey, what would happen if, you know, it's a little lazy research. But yeah, you know, you were mentioning like Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett before, and Chandler has this great quote about a private eye being this man who walks down these mean streets alone. Well, my guys aren't like that. I mean, you know, it's from that tradition. Myron's a wisecracker in that tradition, but he's always with somebody. He's got Wynn, or he has Esperanza, or Big Cindy. He still lives with his parents for a couple of the books and still has a close relationship. So I wanted to take that sort of iconic character, move him into the 21st century, and maybe make him more realistic around the edges, a little more emotional without making him a wimp around the edges. And that's when I created Myron. You know, I did want him to be kind of me with wish fulfillment. He's the man that I want to be. And he does think of the line that you and I wish we thought of while we were there and had the courage to say. And while we both played college basketball at Amherst, he was slightly better than us, I imagine, Ken, that he played at Duke. I mean, I was an All-American, too. What I leave off of that sentence was I was a Jewish All-American. Picked by the Indianapolis Jewish Post and Opinion. I was picked All-American my sophomore year at Amherst, something I don't often brag about. So, you know, a lot of it is, you know, wish fulfillment.
Well, that's pretty big. One part that touches me, too, is how Myron's parents are still there in terms of your own alter ego, that he can deal with his loving father and his humorous and sweet mother and all. And I know you lost your parents earlier, right?
Well, that's
so
sort of what it is. There's two things I wanted to do there. Is one, I had lost my parents at a fairly young age, and maybe this is a little bit of therapy, and I have a habit of overwriting those scenes. Tough, skip them if you don't want to. But also, I'd not seen that done before. Most of the time in these sort of books, the private eye either has no relationship with his parents, or it's terrible. You know, the father abused him or was an alcoholic. So I wanted to reflect, I wanted to show a family that was really kind of intact, and a father similar to mine, who I almost look at now as a father and wonder, well, how did he do it so well? You know, how can I sort of figure out how he managed to push me to excel without pushing me, that sort of a thing. I thought that would be an interesting take, something a lot of times writing, and I'm sure with acting too, is you just want to do it in a way that hasn't been done exactly before. You want to take some of what people expect to happen and turn it on its head.
And Myron Bolitar's father is based on your father, and so you had a great father.
I mean, yeah, very much so. My dad was an amazing guy. His death in 1988, you know, was my first of several family tragedies. But it's that first cut is the deepest, and never quite got over it. In fact, if you go to harlancoben.com, which I don't recommend you do, but if you do, actually, I think, Ken, it's already your default homepage, isn't it, when you first put on your...
Yep, right.
But there's an essay that I wrote, a short story I wrote for the New York Times op-ed page, which it's fiction, but it's based on the death of my own father, that kind of tells the story.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned, too, that you were on your... forget where I was reading, but you're on 40 pages into your new book, and you weren't sure whether Myron Bolitar was going to show up or not, but that was part of the fun of fiction. I remember this long time ago, one of the first shows I did was with Neil Simon, and then I later worked with him again, and he remarked, probably in his writing, but he actually said it to me at one point, that he would start a comedy sometimes with an overall view of where it was all going to go, and then the characters would start changing their minds, and it would start going otherwise, almost like it was out of his control. You know, they just started to make other decisions and move on and fall in love in ways he hadn't planned, and that was, I loved him talking about it, that they had their own lives then, and he was just doing the best to keep up with them. I thought, what a wonderful life of the imagination.
Well, it's true. You know, there's two sides of it. One is it's true, and sometimes, though, it sounds a little precious, but it certainly does occur. In the case of Long Lost, for example, there's always, in each book, there's always this one character who sort of takes over and ends up doing more than I expected. In Long Lost, I had a character who I based on, a French actor who was in Tell No One, a guy named... an actor's name is Francois Berléand, and I knew the character Berléand.
Oh, right.
I really expected him to have one or two scenes in the book, and he just wouldn't leave. And he ends up sort of stealing the book a little bit.
I kept picturing him because I know who he is, and I'd seen Tell No One, and I believe I knew, and I knew even before. So it's a little bit like reading Gone with the Wind and trying to not picture Clark Gable. Is that
it's okay to picture Francois Berléand. I mean, he even knows that it's him. He's also, for those who don't know who he is, he's a fantastic French actor. Besides being in the movie Tell No One, he's probably best known here for being the sidekick in the Trainspotting movies.
Right, right.
And he's just a terrific actor. And the way he portrayed one of the people that I had written in the movie Tell No One inspired me to recreate him yet again and use him as a French detective in Long Lost. But that happens all the time. Where the problem is, like, you want, for the sake of plot, let's say you want Myron to go into a hotel and question the guy behind the desk and get the information. But if you're writing it and all of a sudden you make the guy behind the desk somebody who takes pride in his work or is difficult, and now Myron can't just get the information from him, now it's going to change the plot in a way that, as an author, may drive you nuts but will make the story that much richer and that much better when characters kind of don't do what you want them to do. It's really hard as a writer, and I'm at that stage right now in my new book where I kind of want these people to do this one thing, and it's just not, it doesn't have the ring of authenticity, so I got to figure another way, and it'll take me maybe days or even weeks to come up with how that will be, but I know in the end it will make the book better.
It's fun, the backstories on these characters who are around, Myron Bolitar, too, the more you discover about them, and particularly Wynn. I mean, he's just a fascinating guy. I was wondering how you, I assume with some of these characters, they're just right out of your imagination, but at times maybe an amalgam of, you know, a few people that you've known or this and that.
Well, you'll get a kick that Wynn is probably the only guy based on somebody, and he's based on my Amherst College roommate. And I swear, we were in college together, and he was my... You know, we were an unlikely duo and became best friends literally first week, and he's still my best friend, and I still see him all the time. And he was very good-looking, blonde-haired guy, not unlike you, Ken. And before we would go to fraternity parties or whatever, or mixers or whatever you want to call them, he would actually look in the mirror and say, "It must suck to be ugly." I love sidekicks. I know, be it in movies or TV or books, be it Sherlock Holmes and Watson, Batman and Robin, or even that crummy Running Scared movie with Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal. I love the buddy-buddy aspect. And so I wanted that from Myron, and I thought, what kind of sidekick? The street tough has been done, you know, Spencer and Hawk. The computer geek has been done. I'm trying to think of who to do, and I just took my waspy college roommate, and I tweaked him. My real roommate is not quite that psychotic, and he can't fight his way out of a wet paper bag. But I kind of took him and fooled around with him, and Wynn came to life. But the conversations between Myron and Wynn, I mean, can't you almost see them when you were at Amherst College kind of happening?
They're great fun, and it's always fun to have him correcting you.
Yeah.
You know, that's an ongoing theme. You know,
he would always, you know, he used to do it at Amherst all the time. When somebody's made a mistake like that, he would feel the need to correct them.
To correct them.
Even if half the time he was wrong when he corrected them.
They were a fun bunch.
Thanks.
I was at Homecoming this past year, and I was reading Hold Tight. And right at the time, I think it was Saturday night before I was going to say, I hit page 229, where you discovered that Nash had gone to Williams. And it just...
I've gotten a few emails from Williams people who aren't quite so happy about my psychotic killer being a Williams grad. But again, part of my job is to reflect reality and the truth. He could have been a Wesleyan man, I guess, but no, he had to be a Williams guy.
That's right. I thought it had just the right ring of authenticity to it.
You totally bought it, right? No, I love to do that anyway in books where there's small winks and nods for people who read them all or know me personally or know my background. If 99% of the readers won't get that, they won't get in Long Lost that the restaurant they're eating at was the same one that was in Tell No One or those sort of things. But for those people who do, I think it just adds another layer of fun.
Yes, right. You have a lot of fun with that, don't you? Yeah, you really do.
I've got to amuse myself, too. You know, I got to keep it all fun.
What in the earlier books is has the most to do with that backstory of how Myron Bolitar had his shot at the NBA and then didn't? Is that Deal Breaker or is it later?
Well, it starts with Deal Breaker, but probably the one that deals with the most is Fade Away. Fade Away was my Edgar Award winning book, and I'm pretty proud of it. And I always think it's a good place to start. Though, again, I tell people, if you haven't read a Myron Bolitar, again, I have two sets of books, Myron Bolitars and Standalones. If you haven't read any of the Myrons, really Long Lost, you won't be lost at all, and then you can go back and sort of see where it all started.
That's on a guess. That's what I did in my... My wife got me a Kindle a birthday about a year ago. Of course, I'm addicted.
Great.
It's just so great. So I've already got Fade Away. I just sort of on a guess.
Fade Away is one of my favorites. I mean, I wrote it. It came out in 1996, I think. So it's been a while. But it's one of my. It was at the time. I can't reread my own books. I don't know. Ken, can you watch yourself like in old movies or old TV shows, or do you kind of cringe when you do that?
I think the further back, the easier. I was doing a. And it was all summed up by, I was working with Dick Van Dyke, and it was 1980 back then. And he's marvelous, and a certain shyness to him. And the way he put it was that every now and then late in the evening, he said, you know, and when he was talking to me, his hair was white, you know, and he had a mustache for this part. He said, sometimes on television, you know, he didn't want to say the Dick Van Dyke Show, you know, would come on, and he'd say, and I'll look and I'll think, gee, that young, dark-haired, skinny guy is really funny. I'm sure the same for you. It's very hard to, when you're right up close to it, it's just happened to have real objective judgment on it.
I can't have objective judgment on it even then, but even so, sometimes like the older books will be like, I compare it to that essay you wrote when you were in college you thought was so brilliant,
and you realize you worked too hard.
You go, wow, what was I thinking?
It goes through, I think, a lot of different professions that the general criticism of ourselves earlier is it looks to us like we're working awfully hard. Can you just give an inkling, a little something that about either the title or what's coming in the next book?
I have no idea what the title is yet. You know, one of the weird things is I almost never title my own books. I'm really bad at titles. The only one I've titled over the last, I think, six or seven, I can remember doing two of all of my books, titled Fade Away, and I titled Promise Me. And in fact, I remember when I handed in Tell No One, I'm embarrassed to tell this, but I handed in Tell No One, and the title was Big Bears Fall, which is a horrible title. And my publisher at the time goes, Big Tears Fall. What is this, a Native American story? Well, me, Big Tears Fall. What kind of horrible title is that? So
Tell No One's a good title. Very good title.
And you know, when they first presented it to me, because it was in the book, so they just took it out of the book from the emails, I was like, I don't know, Tell No One, it sounds so generic. But it ends up being, of course, a really good title, which is why you have to know your strengths and weaknesses, and that might be one of my weaknesses.
Do you have a sense of when the American version of Tell No One will come out, or is that...
I don't. You know, they just sold it, supposedly, I think, to Miramax and Universal, and they're trying to get these two producers on board who are doing some kind of... You know, as you well know with your business, it's one step up, two steps back. So, you know, they finally took forever to sell. They wanted to wait till they had exactly the studio and the deal that they wanted. They got it. And now they're some kind of hold up with, I don't want to mention names of the famous producers that want to be attached to it. They want them attached to it. So it's always this way. I have an actor, I can't mention his name either, who's attached to Long Lost. but we can't do it until now the studio wants to make sure the right writer is on board. You know how it works. There's always it's always one step up, two steps back with Hollywood. I have to always listen with half an ear. It's a very, very strange, you know, strange thing for me because I'm used to just writing it, doing it, getting it done. But that's just it never seems to work that way smoothly. I mean, eventually it looks like it's going to happen. So let's say it does and it gets made fast and it comes out next year, 2010. That's 10 years from the time Hollywood first bought Telemann One to make. So it has been a weird and curvy route.
At least here, because you're a wonderful storyteller and you have it in writing. I think one of the problems, and it's become more and more the case with big Hollywood and corporate, is, and I've seen it happen where they're all excited because they have two big, terrific stars together and a famous director. It's like they forget to actually look at what's on the page. You say, this isn't a very good script, you know. I don't care who you've got. And it comes out, and it's not a very interesting story, and whoever the huge stars are, whether it's Brad Pitt with Al Pacino, whatever, you make it up, a fabulous director, it just lies there and it dies and they lose a fortune. So at least in this case, they've got a story to tell.
Well, I mean, hopefully, you know, I'm with you on that, that obviously I'm somewhat biased, so I think it's so much of it is in the story. You know,
it is.
No actor wins it, no matter how great they are, if the role is garbage, you know, if the role has to be well-written and things like that. And, I think Long Lost, for example, would make a truly excellent film. It wasn't intentionally written this way, but as someone said to me, it's like Bourne Identity meets Myron Bolitar meets Boys from Brazil. And I love how you guys pitch out there. It always cracks me up. You know, it's Schindler's List meets Bug's Life. You know, that's how everybody talks out there. So talking that language, it certainly should be a pretty interesting film, if it's made right. But
Myron Bolitar doesn't have to be in our size range, but he better be over 6 feet.
I know, that's the thing. That's the thing. Unfortunately, they want him to be around 30 to 35, or I would say you'd be perfect. You would have been perfect Myron Orwin, Ken, actually. You could have done either one of those. You could have done either role. I don't know. You could have had fun. And both of those, would they not have been fun to play?
Absolutely.
Yeah. If we could go back, if you and Stephen Collins, we could have an all-Amherst cast. It would have been great. Two great Amherst grads right there.
Well, it's a pleasure talking with you. Good luck on this next book.
All right, Ken.